The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
America, 8 days to an election, and what a weekend. Allow my inner sports talk show host to come out. Yeah. I know you want to talk about Trump. I got Jared Kushner coming up at the bottom of the hour. We're going to talk about President Trump. A lot of good straws in the wind, a lot of dangerous data in the wind, very complicated, factually unprecedented set of circumstances going on here. We really don't know a lot of stuff. So everybody's talking through their hat when it comes to the election. But I can honestly say this is the best football weekend I have had in a long, long time. First of all, Justin Fields is freaking amazing. Now, I know all you South Carolina people who I know are going to vote for Lindsey Graham. Get out there and vote early. Lindsey Graham, we're going to confirm a Supreme Court justice today, Amy Coney Barrett, because of Lindsey's chairmanship. Because of Leader McConnell's leadership, because of President Trump's judgment, we are going to get a great justice today. The Supreme Court begins a new era today when Judge Barrett becomes Justice Barrett. But I know all you people down there in South Carolina, despite your great senators, Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott, you've got Trevor Lawrence on your head. Let me tell you, if I'm an NFL scout, I'm looking at Justin Fields on Saturday and saying to myself, whatever Urban Meyer knew 5 years ago when he brought this kid to Columbus, we now know. He missed one pass, and that could have been caught, except Olave got, like, double nailed in the end zone. It's a freak. He makes Lamar Jackson look like me. That is just how good Justin Fields is. The Buckeyes, they're the best team in the country. But then, yesterday's NFL shootout. Now, some of you don't follow sports ball like Kurt Schlichter and Ben Boychuk. And it's a sad thing for you. But if you follow sports ball at all, yesterday's Browns-Bengals game, I'm coming to now. Watch it with my boys. I'm glad there is no video of the Hewitt men at the end of that game when Baker Mayfield drops a dime into the guy from up north, DPJ, Donovan Peoples-Jones. First catch in the end zone, 4 seconds left, fingertip catch right through the arm to the defender. It was freaking amazing. Baker Mayfield threw 20 completions in a row, which is a Browns franchise record. Remember, the Browns begin in 1944. No Cleveland Browns quarterback, not Otto Graham, not Dr. Frank Ryan, not Bernie Kosar, not Brian Sipe, not Mike Phipps, not Bill Nelson, not Tim Couch, not all those quarterbacks on the jersey that you saw forever. None of them ever threw 20 completions in a row. Baker did that yesterday. So Bob Franz comes on WHK 1420, The Answer, in Cleveland after me. And he's always hated Baker. He was always a Sam Darnold guy. And he wanted to draft Mitch Trubisky ahead of Myles Garrett, who also set a Browns record yesterday for consecutive games with his sack. 6. Never been done before by a Brown. So yesterday, 2 franchise records from a franchise that begins in 1944 were set. 1 on offense and 1 on defense. When has that ever happened in the NFL before? Elias Sports Bureau, Pro Football Focus, Terry Pluto, my friend. When has that ever happened? That you had a franchise record set for both an offensive player and a defensive player that wasn't an expansion team? And spare me the jokes. The Browns are the big dogs. in dog's good time, we are going to be on top of those other teams. But it was just a marvelous thing. But I put on my, I'm about to go to politics here in a second. Don't worry, I'll get there. I know some of you people don't care about the Browns and the Buckeyes, but you got to be you, right? You got to be me. If I had a producer, they'd always have queued up, say ma, it, you know, it's me. So good Monday morning to you. I got to tell you what's on my mind. My complaint of the weekend was during the Buckeyes game against the hapless Cornhuskers. I wish Ben Sass was supposed to be on today, but he's in hiding. And the hapless Cornhuskers didn't know what to do. And at halftime of the game, they go to the Fox Sports panel, on which sits Reggie Bush and Matt Leinart, I think, and a couple other guys who are nice guys, you know, got nothing against them, wonderful guys to have a beer with, you know, to talk football. And then they got the coach, right? So they got Urban Meyer, the greatest coach, best coaching mind in America, sitting there. And they don't give him the ball until everyone else has had the ball one or two or three times. I couldn't believe my eyes. Like, I'm screaming at the producer. The main deal is the main deal. I've said this 1,000 times to radio stations across the country when I've gone in their market. The show is the show. You don't want to do a lot of intros. You don't want to have a local pitch man come up and talk. You want to get to the show. The show is the show. So when you got Urban Meyer on the set, you go to Urban Meyer. They finally got to him. But when I was seething, saying, what does the coach think about this freak of nature, Justin Fields, that he's found, I had a brainstorm. And I'm sharing this with the Fox Sports world and with you. Urban Meyer has a restaurant in Columbus called the Pint House. Now, if you grew up when I did, in the 60s and the 70s, it was routine for high school boosters. And I want to know, open the phones. This is just a factual question. 1-800-520-1234. 1-800-520-1234. It was routine in Warren, Ohio, that all of the high school, how can someone be calling? They don't even know what I'm going to ask. Don't talk to that person. That person's a dummy. 1-800-520-1234 after you know the question. When I was growing up, it was routine on Monday or Tuesday night that the coach, Doc McQuaid, Tony Napolitano, whoever it was, would break down the film for the Boosters Club. So you'd get everybody into the cafeteria, all of the, and it's not just the parents or the players, it's the faithful for the high school club, in this case, the Warren Kennedy Eagles. Greatest, I mean, they've won the most championships of quintuple A division in Ohio, I think, in history. And the Warren Eagles faithful are many, and they're great. And they'd won at Mollenkopf or something like that. And they would gather every Monday or Tuesday night, and they would squint, and Coach McQuaid or Coach Napolitano or Coach Bluto or whoever would play on a little screen the film. And they'd break down the film, and they'd go over it. And they do that for a couple hours, and parents who thought they knew something about football would ask a question. And the kids like me who are in, you know, third or fourth grade would sit there and watch these adults talk about football, staring at this little screen. But I didn't figure it out until later. The reason was because at the end they would pass the hat. All right, so at the end of every Boosters film breakdown, they'd pass the hat. And that's how high school sports got funded in America, or we paid for coaches or athletic equipment or gym or weights or whatever. So here's my big idea, and I want to know if other people did that, if their local high school broke down the film. I would go to Urban Meyer's Pint House on Monday night, Fox Sports, and I would have the coach break down film, not just of Ohio State. I'd have him break down all sorts of film. It's a little bit of a John Gruden used to do it in Gruden's quarterback school. But I mean, every Monday night, just college ball, have Coach Meyer break down the film. That would be the highest rated. It might be Tuesday night you'd have to do it because of Monday Night Football. But Tuesday night, what's that? Oh, is it Ben who doesn't watch sports? Good morning, Ben.
How are you, Hugh?
You don't watch sports. You and Schlichter are hopeless.
Well, that is as may be, but as I tried to tell you on Twitter a few minutes ago, we have way too much reading to do to bother ourselves with trivialities like sports. And by the way, what is a Brown?
By the way, number one, if you're watching USC football, you can't read. But number two, even if you are watching USC football, there it's so dull, you can read during a USC football game. It's just Ohio State you can't read through. Are you a Trojan? Do I remember correctly, Ben, you're a Trojan?
No, I'm actually not. I'm a graduate of the University of California at San Diego.
Oh, do they have a football team?
They do not.
They do not. That explains a great deal, doesn't it, Ben?
It actually kind of does.
It doesn't have a football team. That's like the University of California, Irvine, which means they are actually not using the term university correctly. Because a university means football. Ben, what are you doing up at this hour?
I'm working, actually. I don't know if you recall, but I'm managing editor of a publication called American Greatness.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, so are we going to win?
I think so. We've had some good polls. The polls that we've done, and we've conducted a few of them, suggest that the battles in the states are way more important than any of the national polls. So,
what's the best piece of data you can offer my audience?
Look at Arizona. Look at Wisconsin.
I'll tell you what. Hold over during the break. Ben Boychuk of American Greatness, an unexpected first guest who doesn't know anything about breaking down the film with Coach Urban Meyer on Tuesday nights, produced by Hugh Hewitt. Ben, stay over the break and get the best three things people need to know this morning to give them a little lift in their step as we head into the last 8 days of campaign 2020 and the first day of Justice Barrett on the court. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hi, Hugh Hewitt for ReliefFactor.com. If you are in pain and you want out of pain, well, you need to talk to the people that get it done. Pete and Seth Talbot, the father-son owners of ReliefFactor.com. They tell me that sometimes whole families can be helped when one member of the family gets out of pain. For example, finally, a married couple gets to sleep through the night again when one isn't tossing and turning with a terrible back. That's why Pete and Seth created the 3-week quick start, so you can find out if those people are you. For about $1 a day, you can see if you can get out of pain, and after that, lessen the cost of a cup of coffee a week to stay out of pain. The 3-week quick start is like a trial pack, and it can be at your door in about 2 to 3 days. Let's face it, getting older, exercise, even everyday living can create discomfort, pain. You don't order Relief Factor just for yourself. Order it for your wife, your husband, your family, your friends. They miss the old you, too. 3-week quick start at ReliefFactor.com or call 800-500-8384. 800-500-8384. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. On the Monday before the Monday before the election, we got 8 days to go. I see Politico.com as the greatest lead of the day. Florida Republicans are pouring out of the trenches. They are closing the gap. But Ben Boychuk, editor of American Greatness, I asked him to stay over and think of a couple of data points, maybe three, that would encourage GOPers out there today. What say you, Ben?
All right. So we've done a bunch of polling at the under the auspices of the Center for American Greatness. And we've done several polls over the past month, and we've been doing them throughout the summer. And I would just point out the latest ones that we've got. We did a poll in Arizona where Trump took the lead. We've got data from Iowa where the race is tied, and then we've got a tightening race in North Carolina. And what I think it all sort of adds up to is that in the battleground states, the president is doing better than probably expected, and that as more people listen to Joe Biden and see the debates, and certainly that last debate was perfectly weird. I think that it's the tide has turned somewhat. I mean, but also I think it's always also been the case. You know, and I know you've talked about this a fair bit, and this is something that we discuss a lot at American Greatness. You know, the difficulty of divining some of the elements of these polls, which is that people like us, people like my mother or a lot of my friends who are predisposed to vote for the president, are not going to talk to pollsters, or at least they're not going to talk to them candidly. And so there's an aspect of this within the margin of error which suggests that, you know, where it looks like he's lagging, he's probably doing better than it appears.
Well, you know, Ben, I do agree, especially about seniors who are more conflict averse than youth. I really believe they're not in a hurry to start a fight with anyone and they're hiding. But I also believe that a huge turnout, which I think we're going to have, portends a blowout in either direction is possible, and you can't pull it. Their models are all built on 2018 and 2016. I know why, but they have to build a model. They use a data set, and if the data set isn't what we've got, it's useless.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think I would agree with that. I'm really interested to see how this ultimately works because, you know, I wrote a column back in 2016 when I was Trump skeptical, let's say. I wrote a column for the Sacramento Bee, saying that Trump would win, absolutely win. And a lot of it had to do with this sort of shy Trump, shy Tory phenomenon that still hasn't really been well understood. And I think now more than ever, certainly more than 4 years ago, where it's in some places dangerous to express support for this president, that and the fact that pollsters have trouble contacting people, landlines are becoming scarcer.
You're right, Ben. You're right. You can't eat in Northwest D.C. with a Trump sign on. A Trump
Correct.
Button. You cannot eat with a Trump button on in Northwest D.C. I would assume the same as in New York. Ben, I have to roll on. I appreciate the fact that you called, but I want you to watch some football. You need to relax over the weekend, you and Schlichter, but the University of California at San Diego explains a lot, my friend. Ben, good to talk to you. Let me do the market update brought to you by Birch Gold, which you can find at HughGold.com, HughGold.com. Gold is at $1,904 an ounce. That's not where I expected it to be. I thought it would be closer to 1950 this morning as we got closer and closer with the 10-year treasury up to 0.84%. But the market was mixed on Friday and overseas. It's mixed this morning. Hong Kong up, everywhere else down, and Germany down 2.22%. Tell me about that. I don't understand. But I know that gold always makes sense. HughGold.com or text my name Hugh to 474747. When you do that, they'll give you the information on making sure your retirement is secure if you move 10 to 25% of your retirement into physical precious metals. HughGold.com or text Hugh to 474747. Come right back. Jared Kushner is next.
There will be no separate peace between Israel and the Arab world. I want to make that very clear to all of you. I've heard several prominent politicians in Israel sometimes saying, well, the Arab world's in a different place now. We just have to reach out to them and we can work some things with the Arab world and we'll deal with the Palestinians. No, 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 and no. I can tell you that reaffirmed even in the last week as I have talked to leaders of the Arab community. There will be no advance and separate peace with the Arab world without the Palestinian process and Palestinian peace. Everybody needs to understand that. That is a hard reality.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That was former Secretary of State John Kerry at the Brookings Institute when he was Secretary of State in December of 2015. I'm joined now by Assistant to the President Jared Kushner. Good morning, Mr. Kushner. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Has Secretary of State Kerry called you or President Trump or Secretary Pompeo or anybody to congratulate anyone on the Abraham Accords, which he said in December of 2015 simply could never happen?
I have not had direct contact with him, but, you know, he's somebody who I'm sure is rooting for America. And I think that many people have just been very supportive about this deal. I mean, yes, on Friday, we announced the third peace deal in the Middle East in the last couple of months. And, you know, very few presidents make one peace deal, but now President Trump's done three peace deals. And what we're seeing is the more that we've been able to get these deals done, the more countries want to come on board, the more people want to get past old conflicts. And President Trump has taken a different approach, not one that was looked at or thought of by the typical Washington insiders who have done this for a long time, but it's yielding results. And after years of getting criticized for doing it differently and for using unconventional people to do it, people are seeing that that this different approach is one that's really working.
The Abraham Accords, as you said, in 10 weeks have produced three deals. The United Arab Emirates and Israel normalized diplomatic relations. Bahrain and Israel did the same. And then last week, Sudan and Israel did the same. Morocco and Oman are allegedly lined up over the landing field to do the same. It's a diplomatic triumph with very few precedents since the Soviet Union fell. What are the consequences, Jared Kushner? That's the most important thing. What are the consequences for the Middle East of all this diplomatic normalcy breaking out?
Well, you know, what's incredible is, you know, my team was just over there and they all came back saying, you know, man, the feeling is just so much different. And this is such a bigger deal over there than people are allowing it to be over here. But the notion with peace is that it can become as big as you allow it to be. So what happened here was really barriers were broken in the Arab-Israeli conflict that had been up for a very long time. And now the people in the region are really taking hold. And it's almost like we've let a tiger out of the cage and people are rushing to do business, to get to know each other, to visit the tourist sites in each other's countries, and to try to build the bonds that were not allowed to be built because of these artificial barriers that led in place. I mean, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is in many ways was used by Arab leaders for, you know, for 70 years to divert attention and distract from a lot of their shortcomings at home. And they used that to keep a barrier up. It was built off of anti-Semitism and it created a lot of hatred and instability. You look at Iran, you look at, they call their military the Quds Force or the Al-Aqsa Brigade. You know, you look at a lot of these jihadists in Africa, throughout the Middle East, they use the plight of the Palestinian people or the threat of the Al-Aqsa Mosque being under attack in order to get younger people radicalized so they can keep their bad activities going. And what's happening now is people are able to start going to Israel, seeing that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is open to everybody. And it really will, I think, reduce hostility and terrorism throughout the entire region and throughout the entire world because it brings people together. This has just been one of those core conflicts that has been exploited by bad people for half a century, maybe even, you know, close to a full century in order to, you know, push for bad things. And this is really the beginning of that end. So, you know, I believe that we've planted some seeds now, and I think that the short-term returns have been great, but I do believe that the long-term returns are going to be extraordinary if we keep leaning into this. And I do think there will be more peace deals, there will be more coming together, there will be security relationships, business relationships, technology relationships, agriculture relationships, and those will even further cement the relationship between these countries and allow the Middle East to become a more stable place. The final point I'll just make on that is that if you look at from 2001 till today, you know, you look at what China's been able to do as a country by focusing on their infrastructure, their economy. I mean, they did it in certain ways that obviously took advantage of the world and the politicians allowed that to happen. But you look at the Middle East, it's gone backwards. So, you know, the hope is that if they could eliminate some of these wars and instability and security risks and create the right governance structure and the right interconnectivity and eliminate these old problems, the potential for the Middle East could be one of a very exciting emerging market.
Now, Jared Kushner, you mentioned Iran in there. I'm curious, did the killing of Soleimani advance or disrupt momentum towards the Abraham Accords?
I think it helped make the Middle East a more peaceful region. I mean, speaking to a lot of military, U.S. military service members, they spoke about how, again, when America was negotiating the deal with Iran, they were forced to stand back and not take aggression. They said Iran knew that they were in a posture of stand down, and they really toyed with them. They would obviously, you know, really attack different brigades, and it caused a lot of death and casualties to American servicemen that was, you know, very avoidable had they had a posture like President Trump has had, which is, you know, you hit us, we hit you 100 times harder. Instead, it was you could hit us and there'll be no consequence because we're going to telegraph exactly what we're going to do, which is nothing. And so obviously this was he was a mastermind of a lot of the terror and instability in the region and having him not around anymore has, I think, created a much greater opportunity. You look at Iraq, we were speaking with the leaders of Iraq. They're saying that since that happened, Iran is a whole different country. Saudi Arabia says the same thing. You know, Syria's become, you know, a little bit better. Iraq's become more stable. Yemen's become more stable. And, you know, Hezbollah and Hamas have, you know, much, much less resources thanks to the U.S. sanctions that we've put in place under President Trump and thanks to some of the strategic leaders of these wasteful resistance movements obviously being off the board.
Now, you also raise an interesting question about anti-Semitism driving a lot of the previous impasse. Do the Abraham Accords, already with three countries to remind the audience, with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and now Sudan, do they effectively kill the BDS movement, which needs to be killed? Do you think that this momentum has just cut the legs off of the anti-Semitic BDS movement?
Well, I think it's very hard for Europe to be more, you know, kind of more righteous than the Arab countries on issues like this. But the reality is, look, you know, people have romanticized a lot of these different conflicts and made them into things that maybe suit their political needs. But the reality is that you have two disputes there. You have a border dispute, which is really a real estate dispute, which is, you know, 1967, there was a war, it was a defensive war from Israel. Israel then took over the land, and basically, you know, you have thousands of years of claims that both sides make. But, you know, in history, there are wars, and the people resolve it. So at this point, you need to resolve, you know, a border dispute, which is drawing a line. Both sides have two positions. A result is something negotiated. Anything that's negotiated is by definition arbitrary. And you need to resolve that. The second dispute is the Arab-Israeli dispute, which really has to do with the mosque, which I spoke about. And you know, even you go back into the 1920s, there was a mufti named Haj al-Husseini who basically was, you know, going around the world raising money and creating instability. He was friends with Hitler and Mussolini, saying the mosque is under attack. And so what happens now is that we've tried to lay out a resolution to the real estate part of this. And I think that shows, you know, what could be realistic, you know, where you're not displacing Israelis or displacing any Palestinians, but you need to get that resolved. And then you want to allow people to have free access to the mosque. So I think what we've done is we've almost dissected the dispute and allowed people to see, like, this is the rational framework for how we're going to resolve it. And, you know, when I was with the Sultan of Oman, Qaboos, the one who unfortunately passed away, who was a great leader, he said something to me which really, you know, influenced my thinking on this, where he said, you know, I feel bad for the Palestinian people that they carry the burden with them for the Muslim world. And I, you know, in reflecting on that, I said, wait, that's right. You know, who elected the Palestinians to negotiate on behalf of all the Muslim world for issues that pertain to the Muslim world? So, you know, what we've done is we've gotten Israel to agree to affirm that the King of Jordan can be the custodian of the mosque. And we've tried to separate the Arab issues from the Palestinian issues, which we believe at its core is a territorial dispute. And I think that once you dissect that, that allows Israel and the Arab world to start coming together again. Three peace deals in a short period of time is a historic achievement. Some people work in government for 30 years, can never get a single peace agreement. You know, we've done three, and I think we have more coming. And I think what this does to BDS is it just makes it a senseless, you know, it makes it a more nakedly anti-Semitic approach at this point, and something that really should just be eliminated.
Now, Jared Kushner, President Truman recognized Israel in 1948. President Nixon saved it during the Yom Kippur War in 1973. But I think President Trump fairly can be said, along with those two, to have been most critical to Israel because he's led the Arab world to recognize and embrace the existence of Israel. Fair statement?
I believe so. And look, you know, President Trump, he understands American power, American strength. And what he did with the Middle East is his first trip as president was to the Middle East. If you remember the last campaign, the Middle East was a hot topic. You had, you know, basically a genocide in Syria. They were killing Christians. ISIS was running rampant. Iran was fully emboldened, funding proxies that were destabilizing the whole region. And America was still relying on the Middle East for a lot of energy. And so if you think about what President Trump did, he went to Saudi Arabia. He brought together the 54 leaders of Muslim and Arab countries and said, this isn't America's problem. This isn't your problem. It's all of our problem. And, you know, he set up a center there to combat terror finance. We've now gotten into the banking systems of all the Middle Eastern countries. We've reduced the funding of terror by a dramatic amount. We opened up a counter-extremism center in Saudi Arabia. We've seen some tremendous reforms there that will help, you know, reduce the long-term extremism and radicalization of the youth. And we defeated the territorial caliphate of ISIS, which was essential. And I think that you've seen that Iran is a different country today than they were 4 years ago by having their resources significantly hampered. And so I think that President Trump also hasn't allowed these countries to cherry pick or to look at things through a conventional lens and basically say, OK, let's agree on what the goals are. Let's all agree on that. And then let's keep iterating and working to try to find ways to get there. And so, again, over the last 3.5 years, we've been criticized. I mean, me in particular, by all of the, you know, experts who worked on this problem set for a long time. And the reality is that, you know, we took a different approach, but it's that different approach that allowed us to achieve the different results.
You know, Jared Kushner, when they write up the history of this, they'll say peace breaks out in the Middle East, experts hurt the most. The team that you just mentioned, we know about the president and the vice president, you, Secretary of State Pompeo, Robert O'Brien, but there are names like Avi Berkowitz, Captain Mark Vandroff, Brian Hook, Matt Pottinger. We know about Ambassador Friedman, but I had to look up the charge affairs in Sudan, Brian Shukin. You know, we know about Ambassador Al Otaiba and Ron Dermer in the United States, but how many different people are involved in this? What's the team number?
We've got a great team. I mean, you also didn't mention General Miguel Correa, who was also an essential part of the team. You know, we probably have about 15, 20 people on our team who have been working through these issues. Again, you know, I said the other day that, you know, peace deals are not as easy as, you know, President Trump is making them look right now. Again, there's a lot of issues that have to get resolved. You have to build relationships. You have to build trust. And you really have to have some frank discussions. You know, one of, you know, my favorite quotes that I used to use when I was in business, but it applies to this, is that change is like heaven. Everybody wants to go there, but nobody wants to die. And I find in politics, everyone can tell you what's wrong or where they want to get to. But then when it comes to actually making hard changes, people fall all over themselves. And
on that point, Jared Kushner, would this have happened had the embassy not been moved to Jerusalem, which was the first and most difficult choice? Republicans and Democratic presidents alike refused to do it. Was that the essential move on this chessboard?
It's hard to say in retrospect. I mean, people will write the history that they do, but I do think it was an absolutely essential thing. It showed that President Trump was going to keep his word, and it also showed people that a lot of this conflict was a paper tiger. People had so much fear. The intelligence community, the people in the region, they said that if President Trump kept his promise and did it, that it would lead to war and instability like you'd never seen. And then President Trump did it, and then the next morning the sun rose, and the next evening the sun set. And life moved on, and it showed people that, you know, he was going to keep his promises, he was going to do the right thing, and he wasn't going to be bullied. And, you know, he also got some criticism from a lot of the experts who basically said that that he should be getting some concessions from Israel for doing it. But President Trump said, look, A, it's a promise, and B, it's the right thing, and you shouldn't be extracting things for doing the right thing or for keeping your promises. And what he did get from that move was he got the trust of the Israeli people, and then the respect of the rest of the region. And so I guess you can say it was a very essential step.
Now, is it reversible? Is any of this reversible? Do you fear that post-President Trump, whether it's Joe Biden or someone down the road, that someone will undo all this work? Or is the momentum so significant that it has to be maintained?
Look, I'd love to think that it's all the momentum is great and this is going to be a major change in history. But, you know, there are roots now, but everything has to be maintained and has to be watered and has to be tended to. So, you know, I would think that anything's reversible. But I do think that the momentum we've built is strong. But I do believe that if President Trump gets another 4 years, I think the momentum will only accelerate and the results will be extraordinary. So I think 4 more years would make it much harder to be reversible. But I do think there is just tremendous momentum now around this movement. But again, another 4 years would really help cement this legacy and then make it even, you know, 10 times stronger. I do believe that if President Trump wins, Palestinians, you'll resolve that pretty quickly. You'll resolve Iran. You'll get full normalization with all the Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Oman, everybody, because at this point, it's inevitability. We just have to keep with the strategy and, you know, not go back to the old way of doing things, which unfortunately is how a lot of the Washington people, you know, try to do it.
Now, Jared Kushner, I promised an out right now, but if you'll blow through the break, I'll ask you about the First Step Back. Do you have 5 more minutes?
Yeah, of course.
Well, then let me turn to the First Step Back, because like the Abraham Accords, it got almost no play in the debate whatsoever. It's so important. In a June 2020 assessment by the Brennan Center, which is at NYU Law School, it's very liberal. It's named for the great person. It actually has on their website an update, December 21st, 2018, 1:10 p.m. President Trump has signed the First Step Act. And in June 2020, the center's senior counsel, Ames Graubart, wrote, "The First Step Act is intended to do 2 things, cut unnecessarily long federal sentences and improve conditions in federal prisons. More than a year after it was enacted in 2018, key parts of the law are working as promised." What's your assessment, Jared Kushner?
I think it's been a tremendous, tremendous success. I mean, the first step back was a prison and criminal justice reform. It basically did, you know, two things. Is one is it made the prisons more purposeful, right? In America, we've had a debate, what's the purpose of our prison? To warehouse, to punish, or to rehabilitate? And, you know, there's a lot of examples where you have prisons throughout the country that, you know, a lot of future criminals come from your prisons, right? The recidivism rate is too high, so it takes people in prison and it gets them job training or mental health treatment or alcoholism addiction. It helps them with reconnecting with their families or their communities so that, you know, 97% of people who are in prison are going to leave anyway. So when they do leave, you know, we want to give them every chance to not commit a crime again and to be productive members of society. The second thing it did was it rolled back some of the laws from the 94 crime bill that obviously was passed by President Clinton and obviously, you know, Joe Biden was bragging about having written that bill. And that basically did a disproportionate sentencing for crack versus powder. Now, crack was more of a black drug versus, you know, powder cocaine, which is more of a white drug. And the disproportionate impact on the black community meant that a generation of black, young black men really were sentenced to prison for terms that were way longer than they needed to be. And so we overturned some of that, and I think it really made a very big impact. And then 13 states did copycat legislation and followed these rules. And so this was based on what we did in Texas and Georgia, where you can both reduce your costs for warehousing people, reduce crime, and obviously, you know, improve people's lives. So it was a tremendous success, and President Trump was very proud of it. He stood with law enforcement. Most of law enforcement fully endorsed this, and it's a great legacy item that I think is great for the country. It makes our system more fair, our country better off because of it, and it really is just a great, great success.
Now, that's the first time I've ever talked to you on air, Jared Kushner. I've only talked to you twice before off air because I was opposed to the First Step Act. I had my reasons, and you called me, and then you worked those. You called me back and said, we fixed that, and then I support. Did you do that with a lot of people? I mean, how much time did you put into the First Step Act?
I put in a lot. Look, you know, people say Washington's broken, but the reality is that our founding fathers were brilliant in the system they created. And to get a law passed, it shouldn't be easy, right? You have, congressmen and senators from all over the country. You have advocacy groups. You have, you know, people with opinions, and everyone weighs in. And you know, sometimes you have to fight misinformation, and sometimes you have imperfection. And so, you know, when we were doing the legislation, it died about 50 times, but every time it would die, it would be because a strong stakeholder had an objection. And so, you know, obviously you don't want to water it down that it becomes nothing. So you have to negotiate back and forth. But, you know, the point you were raising, I thought was actually a valid point. It was a concern that some people had, which was based on a turn of the draft as it was negotiated. And so I wanted to call you, get your perspective on it. And we were able to get both sides to agree to fix the problem that you thought existed in the law. So again, you know, just because somebody's criticizing it doesn't mean that person's bad. Those people may have valid points of view. So you have to remain flexible and open-minded. And I think the biggest thing we were fighting there too, you know, was obviously some people had valid points like you did, but some people also had misinformation. Like, you know, we had people criticizing us saying, well, this is going to let murderers and rapists out of prison, early. And I basically would try to, I mean, some people you just couldn't reason with. I'd say, wait, you know, what part of you thinks that this is, you know, the strong law and order president who fully backs law enforcement, wants safe communities? What makes you think that he's agreeing to do something that's going to allow rapists and murderers and child molesters out of prison? That's not what this legislation's intended to do, and it's not what it does. And so we were fighting back against that misinformation. But ultimately, and again, you know, there are some criminal justice reforms that we don't support, right? Anything, if taken to a too much of an extreme, could be a bad thing. But the reality is that we were able to do things that made sense. They were tried and true. I think they've both allowed people to have second chances, which, you know, we believe in second chances and redemption. And people shouldn't be judged by the worst mistake they ever make. And I think that what this allows people to do is to get back to their communities and their families and hopefully have a real second chance. But it will lead to lower crime, and it will also lead to lower costs to the taxpayers by not having to pay for people to be locked up in prison who we don't have to be paying for. It's expensive. It could be about $30,000 to $35,000 a year. You could send somebody to college for that amount.
My last question, Jared Kushner, I want to go very high with this, 30,000 feet, and it's back to the Abraham Accords. The very first lecture I heard in college, and you may have had Stanley Hoffman, too, was about the Melian Dialogue and the fact that diplomacy is it doesn't really exist. There's only power relationships. Dr. Kissinger believes strongly in diplomacy. After you've done this, you've just given a sort of standing ovation to the framers on legislation. Does diplomacy actually work, or is it always really the Melian dialogue, the powerful dictating to the less powerful?
Well, I don't think it's one or the other, right? Doctrines are complicated because it's really about application, right? So, you know, when I was in one of the countries, you know, on my first tour, my first year was really about listening more than it was about lecturing, right? And so I was really trying to understand why this had failed, what people's perspectives were, what we could do differently, and then how we should resolve this conflict. And, you know, one of the leaders said to me, you know, Jared, I think you're going to make peace here. I said, well, why do you think that? And he said, well, you know, the U.S. usually sends, you know, one of three people to the region, you know, people who come and fall asleep in meetings. You have people who come and read note cards. You don't have no ability to react. And then you have people who come here and try to convince us to do things that aren't in our interests. And, you know, what you've done is you've come here, you've listened, you're trying to get our perspective. And, you know, I was always a big believer in the win-win deals. And I think that, you know, if you do this the right way, you can build trust. You know, not everything has to be transactional, tit for tat. You know, you don't have to keep a balance sheet. You have to be saying, you know, what can I do to further our interests? You have to build trust. You have to be able to work together. And you have to figure out, how do I create a win-win scenario where all sides do better? And I think that that is achievable. So I guess it's you know, the reality is America does have a lot of power, and you have to you have to obviously work with that. But there's also a notion of you have to build trust and do diplomacy. So I'd say it's probably a combination of those two things.
Jared Kushner, assistant to President Trump, thank you. Good luck in the closing 8 days of the campaign, and congratulations on the Abraham Accords. There are going to be books written about this for decades to come. You've done a great, good thing. Thank you, Jared Kushner.
Thank
I'll be
you.
Right back.
All the best.
Thank you. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. Hi, Hugh Hewitt for ReliefFactor.com. If you are in pain and you want out of pain, well, you need to talk to the people that get it done. Pete and Seth Talbot, the father-son owners of ReliefFactor.com. They tell me that sometimes whole families can be helped when one member of the family gets out of pain. For example, finally, a married couple gets to sleep through the night again when one isn't tossing and turning with a terrible back. That's why Pete and Seth created the 3-week quick start, so you can find out if those people are you. For about $1 a day, you can see if you can get out of pain, and after that, lessen the cost of a cup of coffee a week to stay out of pain. The 3-week quick start is like a trial pack, and it can be at your door in about 2 to 3 days. Let's face it, getting older, exercise, even everyday living can create discomfort, pain. You don't order Relief Factor just for yourself. Order it for your wife, your husband, your family, your friends. They miss the old you, too. A 3-week quick start at ReliefFactor.com or call 800-500-8384. 800-500-8384.